Session number 10252.
Lateral fall.
And I leapt off. Obviously, I had to watch very carefully what was going on at ground level. But having looked both ways very carefully, I decided that in the immediate foreground and behind the slowing trucks was a large bank, and behind that, which looked to be a forested area. The lights by this time were not strong. There were only one or two outriding lights, rather like a flare path. But farther down, 300 or 400 yards down, the lights were in full blaze above the trucks, in batteries of light. So quite obviously one would stand out like a moth against that. I decided then, as soon as the train was standing still, become stationary, I would move as fast as I could into the opposite side, up the bank and into the woods, which I did. I had a good idea, again, which way to go. You must understand that the footing was very bad. I'd learned by now, walking as I had across the lines and other areas, that the rubber boots which I had, which I brought from the mine, which was a moulded rubber, was absolutely useless on frozen surface. They skidded about all over the place. And by the time I'd actually managed to get up the bank after falling several times and got into the forested area under some sort of cover, I decided I wasn't going to be able to move very fast or far without making some form of adjustment. So I, in my canvas sack which I was carrying, only a small one with food and a couple of pairs of socks, a razor, things like this, I took out my spare pair of socks and put them over, thick pair of woolen socks and put them over my boots, which of course made a great deal of difference. I was able to hold fast to the surface and get some traction in what I was doing. But they got very saturated in the context of getting wet. My feet were getting warm, and therefore they were getting saturated. But I got over the ground much better and much more effectively if I'd have left things as they were. Now, the stars were there. I was pointed exactly east, and I kept going. And it wasn't until 2 or 3 hours later, after hard walking over rough, broken, uneven ground, and through forestry aspects, I came to an outlying farm, which appeared to be the perimeter one of several, which in itself joined onto a small village. Again, I took a lot of time in looking out the place, although I was very tired, and again I also had to make a decision as to what to do. I had to get under cover. It was extremely cold. What wasn't actually wet was frozen, and I knew that I had to get some sleep of some sort before going on. I had no idea what the time was, but it must have been in the early hours of the morning, before dawn, and seeing a barn, a large barn, available and enterable, as it were, I managed to get into that, climbed up onto the top bales, and made myself a bed. When one is exhausted, you drop to sleep very quickly, and you sleep very heavily. So I knew nothing at all about what went on in the next few hours, except that in the cold light of dawn, I awoke with a start to feel somebody gently shaking me. And I awoke quickly, as one does in those circumstances, thinking that, this is it, I haven't got very far really, when I saw it was a young girl, about 13 or so, poorly dressed, and looking at me with wide eyes, and asking in a language I didn't understand. I assumed it was Polish. And I said to her, "Do you understand German?" And she said, "Yes, a little." And I said, "I am an Englishman. I am escaped prisoner of war. Can you help me?" And she said, repeated, "Escaped prisoner of war, English." And I said, "Yes." And she said, "Stay here. But whatever you do, be careful now." It was very light, and she said, "I am tending the animals. All around here are people working, and they are Volksdeutsch, and if they see you, they will give you away straight away. My father, who used to own this farm, is now living in one of the huts. And she said, we all live there together. And later, when it's reasonably easy, I will ask him to bring you some food. This is what happened. And he came down, the farmer, the small little moustache, a most un-Polish looking chap, I suppose, attempting in his own way to look rather Germanic so that he wouldn't get the attention that most Poles got from German overseers and people that were utilising their property. And he gave me milk and mealies and some bread. Asked me to be very, very careful because it was a very dangerous situation with Germans all over the place, or Volksdeutsch, and if I was careful and stayed where I was, I could in fact come in and spend the night there before going on the following day. Now, I won't go into great detail about what I found there, except that they were desperately poverty-stricken. They had nothing. The Germans had taken literally everything. But they were very kind to me, and I stayed overnight there, and he set me out on the right road and direction for the border in the east, the border being the General Government Zone, where he said, you're bound to find a small village or hamlet before you get there, and from here on, most of the people that are not working for the Germans, are in the forest, are usually smugglers, and they also work very often with the resistance, and go to and from across the border. So he said, good luck, and I gave him my housewife, which I brought with me, because they were so desperate for wool or anything which she could darn with. The woman was absolutely delighted at that, and I wonder where it is to this day. In Poland, perhaps still, is she keeping it still as a souvenir, this housewife with all the needles and threads and cotton and thimbles and what have you, a pair of small scissors. They did me proud, and whatever had happened, if they'd have been found, they'd have been shot out of hand, so I have them to thank for that. I went on from there, and true to his word, and as he had suggested, I went on for perhaps three quarters of a day, and towards the end of the day, it was desperately cold again, and I was hoping I could get some shelter, but I hadn't seen anything. I'd been in tundra, belts of tundra for the whole time, and I came across a clearing, and in the water of a small stream near a rather ramshackle house was an old lady. Looked as if she'd been doing some washing. She was dragging her stuff out and pummeling it on a stone. And I walked up to her. I was absolutely exhausted, really, and I said to her in German, excuse me, but I'm a British prisoner of war. Can you help me? And she looked up at me, having heard what I said, but perhaps not understanding, but knew it was German, looked at me, and I must realise I must have looked pretty Germanic, fair hair, close-cropped, and tall, and pale-faced, and she fled, and from the direction she came, three people came out in about 5 minutes, very well-dressed. They were men. They had hats on, fur hats. They had quilted jackets. They had stifles, the big leather boots, and they had also pistols. And they came with great determination to me and said, the first person in German said, who are you? And I said, I'm a British prisoner of war. I've escaped from a British working party. Where? I told him, Dombrowa. He said, what were you doing there? I told him. He said, it's nothing of the sort. You're German. I said, I'm certainly not. I said, I've stayed at a house down the road there if you'd like to go back, or a farm. I explained to him where it was. He said, I don't know any such farm. I said, well, I can take you to it. I knew that I was on trial here. I was desperately keen for them to accept me, because I did know that they had a difficult situation as well, and there was Volksdeutsch all over the place. It was easy, one of them, to have spoken a bit of English and try to get accepted that way. Then said, well, we don't really believe you, so we're going to have to punish you. And I said, well, what does that mean? He said, well, we're not sure about you, but we don't believe you. And he said, if we don't believe you eventually, you're going to be shot, because we can't afford it. He said, you may be what you say you are, or you may not. We cannot afford to put a foot wrong. In other words, he said, to make a mistake, or make an inch in Polish, make an inch, which is In German, the same thing. You can't afford to make a mistake. So I said, I understood. I said, I don't know who you are, but I take it you're doing something in the area which you don't want the Germans to know about. And he didn't make any comment. However, I went back to a very large hut with them, which seemed to be very well heated, and certainly there were plenty of food there. They gave me some small amount of food, it stuck me in the corner, as it were, and told me to be good while I was sitting there, otherwise it would be worse for me. And I had a drink as well, and one of them went out. Now, about 3 hours later, by this time I was asleep in a chair in the corner, they came back, and with them they had a person that spoke to me, and in what he imagined was English. I can only describe it as being archaic Shakespearean. It's almost like hearing Shakespeare speak with these and thou and everything else in that time warp. But when I spoke to him more, when he got speaking, it became a little bit more fluent and a bit more practical in the application. And I learned that he was a professor of English at Krakow University. But of course, as he told me, and as I learned afterwards, they had in fact shot most of the people after a general roundup there 9 months before. And anybody that was anybody got away from that particular Holocaust. They were running wild, either with resistance or in the forests, or they couldn't even stay in Krakow itself because they were hunted. They were known, people knew who they were. Germans knew who they were. And he was a professor of English. And he spoke to me at length and then said, well, your English is good, obviously, but we still can't really believe what you've said. You've come through areas where there are military training, where there are minefields. I said, yes, but I travel by train. And he said, well, they're all very, very closely guarded, the trains. And when I said about getting out of the mine, he said, well, yes, but he said, you know, on balance, I'm afraid we don't really believe what you're saying. And I said, he said, but there is one way. Gave him my rank, my number, everything else. He came back the next day. I slept in the more early morning. He came in, and he was a different person. He came in, and he said he'd been in contact with London. It's exactly what he told me. When he first told me, I thought he said, because he knew who I was then, so I suppose it didn't matter what he was saying. But he was convinced that I was what I was because he checked with London and they confirmed exactly who I was. And they were all smiles and handshakes and thanked the British for coming in to help and that sort of thing. But I tell you, I was still a bit, they'd been very, very shaky the previous day and I was still a bit on my mettle over all that. And he said, no, you're perfectly all right now, but he said, now we have to get you to Krakow. And to do that, you have to cross the border. And that is difficult for anybody. But he said, these two people here are smugglers, they go back and forth, and they will take her. They're going tomorrow, that day. They're going later on today, and they will take her. He said, what I'll do is I will give them a small photograph. He was a reserve officer himself, and on the training school where he'd been previous to the war, he had his little group taken with the people that were training with him, and he put a cross above the top of one person's head in the photograph. And he told these people to take me to that address in Krakow, which was written on the back. And he said, and he told them to tell this person who I was, and that we'd been sent from that particular person, university professor, and would this fellow in Krakow look after me. We had in those circumstances, our load and my heart was lighter, but we had a long 5 days' journey on foot, crossing over the border, which was under strict surveillance by border patrols, in the depth of the night in snow. You couldn't even breathe on some occasions, but as they went by in skis, these chaps had it absolutely worked out. And whilst one was up close behind the bush, almost on top of the ski run, the other would beckon from the back, and that's how we got across. As they went past, so we went over. The chap behind, the third man behind, I was the second, fellow leading was the first, the last chap was dragging a large piece of fir tree behind him to obliterate the footprints in the snow so that the border guards wouldn't notice that somebody had crossed their path. That was pretty obvious when you think about it, but it what isn't something I'd have done at the time. That was quite a story in itself, as I before I got to Krakow, because halfway across, in still in the zone itself, without crossing out the other side, I was suddenly thrust down after an hour's walking into a sort of a there was an old rubble on top of the ground there, like an old demolished house, and I was thrust into the side of it, and down we went into a cellar, a basement. And lo and behold, opening the door there was an enormous crowd of people, something like 30 or 40. And they were all obviously doing the same thing, coming back and forth, smuggling. They had all sorts of stuff with them. And it was just like a meeting in Piccadilly Circus. And there they were, sitting around, and they were asking the people that had taken me, who is this fellow? And they were explaining to him who I was, and they were trying to speak to me in Polish or whatever. I couldn't understand the word they were talking about. They were all coming up and patting me on the shoulder and saying, good, very good. And it was quite an occasion. However, we eventually reached the outskirts of Krakow, and I was passed over to this gentleman who was in the photograph, who was a reserve officer, who was since working in the local partisan group. In fact, he was in charge of the partisan group. His name was Captain Fawenga. Walwalega, and one crosses the L in Polish, making it Fawenga. I'll tell you, it gives the spelling afterwards. Captain Fawenga, code name Jur, J-U-R, code name Jur, J-U-R. Jur is a mountain lion or cougar. I was passed on to other people from there who, because of my non-aptitude with the language and my lack of any sort of papers or anything, it was very, very difficult for them to keep me in a close proximity of Krakow, because that was a very dangerous, large city to be in. The Germans were rife there. An awful lot of people had been picked up already during that particular week. They sent me out to a farm in, the, if you like, a safe house, as it were. It was a lovely farm. It was out in a place called Skola. S-K-O-L-A. S-K-O-L-A. Again, a strike through the L and you have Skola. Here I was put with a family who also was working in resistance, well, with partisans, and under Jure's group. And there they, I started to pick up Polish from them. There was a daughter and a daughter and a son of the family who were active partisans, and they came with me everywhere. The son had some English, so that was extremely helpful. And he introduced me that week to another reasonably quite fluent speaking English 18-year-old student, originally from Lwów, eastern Poland, which has come down to Krakow. And his name, Janusz Pańczkowski, give us a spelling afterwards, code name Drem, D-R-E-M. Now, they knew, because I discussed with them, whilst we had this time on our hands, and we were talking about various things, asked me what I wanted to do, how could they help me, and I told them I wanted to get back home. I wanted to go home. I wanted to get up to Stettin again or something like that, one of the Baltic ports, and to get on a Swedish boat or whatever and get home. It didn't matter, I said, whether we went to the Baltic states and got across from Riga, Latvia, or anywhere like this. It didn't matter. And they said, well, this is all possible, but you understand it's going to be terribly difficult at the moment, you travelling with Polish papers on trains and things. And no way I'll stand up to any sort of questioning, and none of us could possibly come with you, because they explained to me that you had to have a special permit, each Pole, for going 16 miles outside the area in which you lived. This meant that you had to have succession of permits, and it wasn't possible unless you were doing it legitimately and through the Arbeitsamt, the German, or the Fertsamt or whatever, you know, the travel agencies. So, Whilst we were discussing all this situation, they were gradually getting on with their job. They were working by putting mines and detonators and derailing railway from the Krakow line up to Kielce and Radom. And this was a very big operation because there were four groups coordinating to do this, and they were bringing off a lot of stuff which was going to not only material which was going up to the Eastern Front, but across the German troop trains as well were derailed, and there was hell to pay in some areas by the fact they caused so much damage. They were very keen and they didn't seem to give a damn for their own safety. They were security minded, and I learned that the cells were all six in number. You had six, two threes really, two threes. And on that six you had a three that knew about everything, need to know, and the other three were people that were asked to do certain things. So that if one of you were picked up, nobody knew anybody else in the group, and they only knew them by code name. I learned the names I've given you, except Janusz Pańczkowski, because I went right the way through with him. But the other names I learned, apart from their code names, I only learned after the war. And so as we were going on, but then it's getting into 6 months and I'm realising that there isn't going to be a great deal of chance of doing anything else but continuing to help these in what they're doing. And I became rather proficient, in addition to which I could use the radios very well. And they found me a very useful person to have. And again, in addition to that, I was gradually picking up phonetically the Polish. It wasn't anything like fluent, and I had little grammar, and I certainly couldn't write it. But it was enough for me to understand, and they understood me reasonably well. I was fortunate in having Janusz Pańczkowski, or Drem, with me, because he was quite fluent in English, and in the early stages especially, he was probably the difference between me staying with the groups and doing what I did, and not staying, because it was possible through him to do almost everything they did and to understand what they were doing, as you can well imagine. As I became more proficient, however, it was less necessary for him to be on my shoulder all the time, and I think it's true to say that when one has to learn, in those circumstances, when that's all you hear every day, you learn quickly. It's a question of self-survival. And so phonetically I became quite good. And I then decided what I was doing was very important. I could see the extent and nature of what they were doing, and I decided to stay with that. And they were very happy about it. I went into Kraków 2 months after I arrived in Poland, and there I saw again Captain Fawenga, and he at a rendezvous, and he provided me with papers, a lot of Polish money, and all the necessary things that one has to have, travel Arbeitskarte, Zugausweis, and things like this, travel permit and things like this. Addition to which, of course, I had civilian clothing. And I had an identity card which showed me working as a clerk in a local factory, a grass-cutting factory. I was pleased that nobody ever questioned me about cutting turf, because I hadn't the slightest idea. But there was somebody working in that particular office that would have covered for me had they phoned or anything like that. Now, during that time, of course, we did a lot. We covered a lot, we spoke about a lot. Always we were looking for means of extending this type of sabotage and train derailments and anything that we could possibly do to assist in what we were trying to achieve. But above all, we were always looking for something a bit bigger, and it came a bit later, a month later, when four groups combined together to attack, go down, be driven down to Przemysh, PRZ, MYSL, and the L structure again, Przemysh, to make a raid on the local Gestapo headquarters in Przemysh. They had two prisoners there, and they had an awful lot of arms and ammunition. Now, the raid itself, without going into detail, went extremely well. It was well organised, and there were four large groups, something like about 300 men taking part.
Could you give a bit of detail about it?
I'm sorry?
Could you give a bit of detail about it?
It was organised from clandestine meetings previously, and all the senior persons of our group and on four other groups, three other groups, were involved. We came separately to Przemysl, which was something like 150 miles away, by transport variously, some by road, some by train. We were given safe houses, each group looking after themselves in that respect, around the Przemysl area. And we had three people working in the, what you might say, the working office of the Gestapo headquarters, the people giving out information on which jobs they could do, which they couldn't do, administrative advice and things like this. Three Poles that were working in that particular office gave us all we required as far as information went as to the state of readiness of the troops, the guarding, the nature of the guards, things like this. And we obviously took a period of time. It was early evening when everything was its slackest and it was less guarded than normal. Now, the raid was carried out, as I say, towards dusk. I suppose at that time in the winter it would be about 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
Which month would it have been in?
Sorry?
Which month would it have been in?
February. And coordination was from four sides. Three people went in as Germans, first of all. They were fluent German speakers and they had German uniforms. They went in and one took one guard out and two of them got into the area where they could actually advise us, looking from various aspects, visible points, what was happening. 25 people went in then through the major doors which were opened by these three in there. And there was a small stockade where most of the SS people that were off duty used to either drink or have a... It was a small cafe and a stockade. I mean, they sat about and did things. It was covered. The 25 that went in and followed went in straight in with the Schmeissers and whatever else they had and grenades. And they took most of those out straight away, most of the SS people there straight away. We were following and covering our contingent. And it was because we were so late on the scene, as it were, it had been done. They released the two Polish prisoners. Most of the Gestapo in the headquarters had been killed. Unfortunately, one of the telegraphists got warning signals off before the wires could be cut. That was one of the aspects of which should have been taken care of well and early, and probably wasn't done quite so early. These things happen in some of these raids when a lot of people are involved, I'm afraid, and all want to do sometimes what they wish to do. The Poles were bravery itself, but they weren't always good on the tactics for coordinating in that respect, as I found when I was in the Air Force. They tend to do what they want to do rather than do what they're asked to do. But however, that was done so that the alarm was set there, and it meant in effect that we were last leaving the scene, and as such the mobile forces of Field Schutz